Thanks, Andrew. I love that. We started with the fact that everyone has a St Kilda story, and something I've learned is that half those people have a Majestic story. I'm just blown away. It's quite exciting. I'd just like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to elders past and present. My self-published book, Majestic, here it is, in its glory, was published in November 2015, and it tells the story of an apartment complex located along Fitzroy Street. So we're around the corner from Ackland Street and up the hill and opposite the bowling club, if you can sort of visualise that sort of part of St Kilda on the way up to the junction. So we're on the top of the hill of Fitzroy Street. When I purchased my apartment back in 2012, I was immediately intrigued. And there were lots of visible cues to the history. They included the stucco walls, pressed metal ceilings in my apartment, and the sheer size of the apartment itself. It wasn't a typical St Kilda apartment, being a closet or something even smaller. It's a huge Edwardian-style apartment, almost the size of a house. The Majestic was blazoned on the front of the building itself in a lovely script, and there was a lovely portico across the front and everything else that was indicating to me there's a history here, this is interesting. I couldn't also help wonder what you couldn't see and what the stories were that you couldn't see. For example, the majority of the contemporary Majestic is new. Only the front part of the Majestic, which you can see there in the photo on the Fitzroy Street, is the old original Majestic. Everything behind it, three quarters of the Majestic has vanished and it's a new complex. So what was there before? Why did it vanish? What happened? How did the wing that I live in survive, were questions I was asking myself. How did the building itself relate to its neighbours? We've got the Waldorf on one side, the Banff and the Regal on the other. How does it fit in its own landscape? And then also a bigger question which interested me and fascinates me still is, what was the context of apartment living generally in Melbourne? I'm a New South Wales boy, I've only been here for 5 years, and the history of apartments seems to be very different in Melbourne than it is in Sydney, and you can just see that in the visual sense. So all those questions started to emerge for me, and lots of nights Googling on my lap on my trusty iPad, the project began to get bigger and bigger. And this is actually the result of those questions which I started with. I say up front that I'm not a professional historian. A PhD doesn't sit on my wall. My muse, I guess, are lots of reading and researching and collecting and talking to people about history. And just as I was thinking about all these things and the project was happening, I'm a bit of a Facebook user, and my partner Rodney will tell you how much I'm on Facebook. An interesting conversation happened on Facebook with a few of my friends who are professional historians, and one of them said exactly what you can see up here, and it was quite an interesting thing to get my head around about where I fit in the scheme of the world. Just because you submitted your own tax return doesn't make you an accountant, his friend said. Just because you defend yourself in court doesn't make you a lawyer. Just because you visited an archive doesn't make you a historian. I'm getting tired of it, of this anyone can do this line. So then one person then responded and said, why don't we just add an appropriate adjective to settle our discussion? Academic historian, popular historian, family historian. So for the Majestic project, that settled me, and I thought, okay, I'll be a local historian. So as the project started, it uncovered a variety of stories, and I'm going to quickly summarise a couple of those stories for you tonight and then tell you a bit about the nuts and bolts of what I did to get this into my hot little hand. The first story of the Majestic is an architectural one. The Majestic remains one of Melbourne's earliest surviving purpose-built apartment buildings. It was built 103 years ago and consisted of suites on the front portion of the building of four rooms. That included a kitchen, a bathroom, a toilet, as well as bedrooms and a reception area. So they were quite significant apartments. Behind them, there were two wings of smaller suites which shared facilities. So it was more of the residential hotel type concept. And the complex itself, the whole big kit and caboodle, included a dining room, a guest lounge, garage, staff quarters, kitchen, office, and a cafe. And I love the fact that in 1912 a cafe was incorporated into this, far earlier than the immigrant history that we also have in St Kilda, and that's an interesting research point if we ever get to it. And then on the top of the whole complex, a tennis court was planned on the top of the whole building, but it seems that wasn't actually built, but it was intended. The building itself, back in 1912, began to sort of mirrored what was happening elsewhere in the world. It was a very early history for Melbourne, the whole notion of apartment living, a very unusual way to live. And we all know the history of apartment living throughout the world. It was well and truly a favoured way of living in many places, such as London, New York and Paris and other places. And we have some great models along the lines of even the names. I mean, there's the Waldorf and the Majestic in New York. So you can see some of the similarities that we picked up in St Kilda. Here in Melbourne, though, not a lot was happening until about 1906. Before then, people lived in communal living in different ways, in tenement living, tenement houses, other boarding-type arrangements. But in terms of apartments, which I define to be self-contained with a bathroom and a kitchen, the first was the Age newspaper owner, David Symes, built Melbourne Mansions up on Collins Street in 1906. And it was demolished in 1958. Probably Melbourne's earliest survivor is one called Whitehall, which is down in Bank Place. And it is still a residential apartment complex, but it's a hotel complex, so it's reconfigured totally inside. It's not as it was originally, but the purpose of its being is still the same. Out in the suburbs, we see some more examples, still around the same period. Faulkner Mansions on Punt Road was built in 1911, so that was a little bit before the Majestic and just after the Symes building up on Collins Street. And it's defied very quietly all attempts of many different governments to demolish it to widen Punt Road, of course. It's on prime real estate there for a super-duper highway, and it's still there defying all of those attempts, and it's one of the earliest surviving purpose-built apartment blocks that I can find in the suburbs. Just around the corner from me in Fitzroy Street is the Canterbury Flats, built in 1914, and it's another complete survivor and still used as for the purpose from which it was built. Very interestingly, just 20 years after it was built, the owners decided to update. It got old-fashioned in just 20 years. So in the 1930s, they removed the Edwardian gable completely. They put metal windows into the verandas. Some have described that to be Chicago-esque. I don't know whether I quite go that far, but it's an interesting description. An illuminated portico was built out over the footpath, and the whole complex was painted with a nice bright coat of white paint with grey and maroon canvas awnings. So they totally gave it a bit of a tart-up and changed the look of the place. Both of these photos are in the collection here at the Royal Historical Society and are complete gems, particularly the one of the residence lounge room, communal lounge room, which I thought is really exciting. So that's the first story, and it's an architectural one. And I think that the history of the Majestic is a significant one in Melbourne's apartment/flat living history. And there's more to be told about that. So my interest at the moment is beginning to contrast that to other things that were happening both in Melbourne and Sydney. The next story is that came out of the work was one of a significant time of change in St Kilda. We've just been through the history of Ackland Street and saw rapid change throughout its history. Similarly, just around the corner and up the hill on Fitzroy Street, it's changed dramatically. As fashions and needs changed, obviously the way that people used their properties also changed. I was very excited to find that generations of families had lived in the block where the Majestic rests prior to it being built. And here's one of my first examples here. I fell over myself when I found this up at the Treasury. I was just walking around. We were having a bit of a Sunday afternoon at an exhibition and came across this on the wall and then followed it up through the Public Records Office, an isometric map of Melbourne. And I was able to hone in exactly on my block there. A bit hard to... for me to point to it, but it's got Princess Street. Maybe I'll come around here. Here's the station, Bowling Green. The current Bowling Green is about here, if anyone sort of knows the local area. Here's Grey Street, that's the George Hotel. Here's Princess Street here, and this is all the park, of course. There's the railway, it used to go over to Windsor. So here's my block, and here's about where the Majestic was around here. And so it shows a couple of very early houses on a laneway looking out over the parklands, and a vacant block, which is where the Majestic popped up. This one is a photo from about the 1890s, and it shows similar things. There's the George, so that's Grey Street, the railway is there, my block is up here, and so along here, if you squint and get your magnifying glass out, you can make out significant boom-style villas. Which were there. That then took me to a variety of different maps, including the Vardy map, looking at, this is a very early one, what's it, 1873? That goes a little bit back to that isometric picture. What was there for the Majestic was not a lot, because it was built where the houses were built in the paddocks that had the other houses there. But then by the 1890s, and I don't have a photo of that map, we could see that there were substantial villas built all along that street. And then I started looking at the variety of different things from rate books and whatnot, and you could write another whole history there of all the different people who lived there. Long story short is lots and lots of families lived in three houses where the Majestic now stands over a period of about 50 years. In the final end, one family owned the three houses and they rented them, and then our fellow came along and bought them, demolished them, and built the Majestic. So that was the second story. The first story was an architectural one. The second story is a story of change. There was a lot there before the Majestic appeared. The next story that I find really exciting is one about the people who lived there. And, of course, in 100 years, thousands of people have called the Majestic home. And I tell a few of the stories in the book. But for me, the most interesting one is centred on World War One. And I was really excited to find in the National Archives, actually, a range of surviving documents about police records of investigating reports of suspicious activities at the Majestic. And it turns out we're not being swamped by Asians or Muslims, but back in World War One, we're being swamped by Germans. And there were a significant number of German people with German origins who lived at the Majestic back just when it was built. And I mean, I don't know much about those families. They could have been here for quite some time. I don't know that. But other neighbours then began to get nervous and made all sorts of allegations. One of them, a fellow called Mr. Stewart, who was a Melbourne City engineer. So he was obviously a significant player. There's a lot you can read about him. Just if you just Google him, you come up with all sorts of things. So he was obviously a man of means and also of great interest. But he alleged that, and this is a quote, "Mr. Fiedler signals with a heliograph on a tripod stand from his veranda. He has a clear view of the interned steamers and of Williamstown. Mr. Hecht," he continues, "very frequently operates a spring window blind so much it appears to be used for signalling purposes." So the police came in, they raided top to bottom, had a bit of a look, they found nothing. Another fellow complained, and he wrote to the newspaper and made a complaint about after one major battle had occurred, there was a major party at the Majestic, and so they obviously must have been celebrating that the enemy had just won a battle, and that launched another investigation while they looked for radio transmitters and goodness knows what else. But in the end, the investigating police officer had concluded that the man that made the allegations had actually been financially ruined by the war. He had significant investments in Broken Hill Mines. At the start of the war, Broken Hill Mines then severed their ties to Germany, and everybody who had shares in the mine bottomed out financially, and because they lost out in terms of their market had vanished. So obviously in spite and whatever else, this fellow had made up all of these allegations. So to me, that third story is an interesting one, just the people. And there's a million and one stories, and I could talk all night about those, but if you buy the book, you can read a few more. The next story that I find a fascinating one is the story of the builder himself. A fellow called John Robert Daly. He was a very ambitious man and a good businessman as well. He came originally from Bendigo and he built a number of significant buildings up there in Bendigo, including St Aidan's Orphanage, a fire station, a range of shops, a church, as well as a grand house for his family. He survived the 1890s depression by relocating his business to South Africa. So he and his family went to South Africa and he seemed to do quite well in the 1890s when many people back here didn't. And then he returned and decided that he'd go back to Bendigo and find whatever gold was left in Bendigo, and he had a range of contracts with old mines to dredge some of the old pickings, and he made a few dollars, enough to put in his pocket to come back to Melbourne and start developing Melbourne. And he's one of the early developers of Elwood when they began to drain the swamp out there and put the tram through. There are probably four, five, six or even more streets that he just bought up and just developed speculative houses. The St Kilda rate books are just full of his work. Each year, five, six, seven, eight, nine houses that he put up in Elwood. Then he came up the hill and he came over to St Kilda and he bought basically the block that I was pointing out in that earlier isometric picture between Princess Street and Grey Street. He basically bought the lot and then further down Fitzroy Street as well. He started by building the Waldorf residential hotel next door to us in 1911, and it was really along the lines of the New York apartment residential living. It was a self-contained residential apartment sort of run along hotel lines, a little bit different to what the Majestic turned out to be. I've missed that one. Have a quick look there. There's a couple of his buildings up there in Bendigo, as well as a terrific photo that one of his grandchildren gave me permission to use in the book out of their family album, and that's the Majestic. And I love, apparently, their grandmother was a photographer, and so they've got quite extensive photos, which are terrific for a historian. And I love this one because that's titled The Majestic Looking Hectic. 1927, when the Prince of Wales visited Australia, I think, to open Parliament. There's a story about him visiting, and then he went up to Canberra to open Parliament. So then further down the street in Fitzroy Street, so just imagine if you're on the hill up where the bowling club is and you're heading down towards the bay. On the left-hand side, he owned the lot all the way along here. There's a little photograph here showing a few of the old mansions and the gardens in front of them. He owned four of those mansions, Brooklawn, Strathmore, Abadour and the Villa. Three of those are still there, the others aren't. And he hoped to redevelop these old mansions in exactly the same way as he did up the hill where the Majestic was, and that's come in, demolish the lot and build something new. But the council put a stop to that, and their planning laws were such that his proposal on the first building, Brooklawn, he was going to demolish and build a three or four storey temperance hotel, and the council wouldn't have that. So he didn't like it, so he wrote a letter to the council and he said, "I'm leaving the old buildings intact with a few alterations, and I'm erecting on the frontage small, unsightly lock-up shops, which I have no hesitation in saying are a disgrace to this thoroughfare. But I have no doubt that they'll be more in keeping with the majority of your council." So it's thankful for that debacle that we still have the old mansions on Fitzroy Street. And what he did, he built the shops, which are still there, in front in the gardens of the old mansions. And so there's a photo there of one of the shops which is still there. It's a little French restaurant. In the old days, there was an earlier French restaurant and a bookstore on the other side. They were his properties. So in some ways, we lost out. We didn't get the developments that we saw a bit further up the road, the Waldorfs, the Majestics and whatnot. But the community won in the sense that we still have our old mansions and the unsightly shops. The final story that my work has uncovered, for me at least, was what some call the St Kilda spirit, and we touched on that earlier, just how unusual this community is of St Kilda in some ways. And I define that as a stoic acceptance of difference, also an acceptance of change, and just an insistence on a fair go for all. And it's just, it seems to be in the blood of the suburb. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, when St Kilda was undergoing significant change, some call this gentrification, the local community stood together and they wanted to protect the vulnerable, the people who had been there and who had very few life choices. Many individuals and organisations worked hard to balance the challenges that gentrification brought to make sure that the spirit of St Kilda remained unchanged. Long story short, there's a whole chapter in the book about this, the Majestic and the facade of its neighbour, the Regal, in all of the redevelopment that happened in the 1990s, became private residences and businesses, and the rear of the Regal became social housing. So now in 2016, we have three major private apartment complexes, and at the back of one, so one third, is social housing. That's a good compromise in my view. I'll just end by talking a little bit about, I guess, the nuts and bolts of what happened and where I went with this. Locating these stories and then writing about them and self-publishing was immensely rewarding, obviously. Like most in this room, my early researching days required lengthy library visits and scrambling through card catalogues and going home with microfiche migraine. And I was genuinely surprised at actually what was on the internet. And that's, for somebody who's working who can't always get to the library and those other things, that's a real asset. It's opened up the world of history to everyone. So comfortable in my 90s, sitting on the lounge each night, watching telly, and who says men can't multitask? I've done it. I was able to locate and chat with people who knew the building by social media and email. I came across a wonderful fellow called Shane Shags, I think he calls himself, and he gave me all sorts of stories about the early days of bed bugs and some of the bands that came through in the late 70s, early 80s. So people were at my fingertips telling their stories. Then thousands and thousands of newspapers on Trove. You know, I mean, it's just immense. You can it's just so exciting. I get goosebumps when I think of it, and that's an immense asset to us all. And then our online indexes and catalogues began to open up the archive. So rather than setting aside a day to go and find what I wanted to find, I knew what I was going for and I could go and quickly access it and off you go. So it was very time efficient. And then even online shopping, would you believe? I'm a good eBayer, I love my eBay. That photo, the 1890s one I showed you of Fitzroy Street, I bought from Paris. It had ended up in Paris, I found it in Paris. Of all places, St Kilda postcards, hotel advertising, just all bought on eBay on the lounge sitting in my 90. I connected to family through ancestry.com. They just all then just appeared. They were amazing and so generous and excited about what was happening. And I did that initial contact through ancestry.com. And just as an aside, I have to tell the story that the work of investigating the family debunked the myth of Fitzroy Street. And there's a wonderful cafe called the Banff Cafe. People might know that Banff is an apartment complex, it's a cafe within the complex. The current owners and many other people think that the Banff is named after the Canadian Banff. It's not. My fellow, John Daly's son, developed the Banff. He demolished the theatre and built the Banff complex in 1940, 1941. And the family history is that his mother's family, the Sim family, came from Banff in Scotland. And so that's an interesting aside of just connecting to the family. So then locating all of these wonderful things, it's a matter then of what do you do with it all? I don't know about you, but this is my first attempt at self-publishing in 1984 when I was 16. Get out your typewriter, do all your things and whack up a book. There it was, The Purcell Family. It wasn't a bestseller. I think I distributed two copies. So then I was thinking, OK, so what do you do about it all? So I was reflecting, obviously I'm not a J.K. Rowling. The publishers won't want to deal with my stuff. The information itself, I've got a small market, so I need to think about how I do this. And I began to reflect on what I like about a book as well and design features and so on. And so then I went to an adult education course and just learned a bit about self-publishing just here in local Melbourne, and I learned all about the nuts and bolts of what to do in order to help get what's up here into print. And that's where St Kilda Press was born. And so I've established a company just simply called St Kilda Press just to self-publish my own work. I say as an aside, though, that part of me was a little bit cautious about self-publishing because it was a part of this new sharing economy business that's happening now? Is it a book version of Uber or Airbnb? And my bread and butter, just to give you a context, is I'm a union organiser. I work up at RMIT University representing the interests of staff, and so I'm a little bit cautious about this sharing economy thing, and would love to have a chat about that at some stage. Was I treading on toes? Was I contributing to the shrinking Australian publishing industry by going down this track? So that all those things were happening as I was trying to, in my own head at least, while I was trying to get this together. And so my compromise, I guess, was to do it all locally. And I found a terrific graphic designer from Northcote, and I printed it over with a terrific guy in Footscray who had a wonderful new way of printing through digital media. So for me, it cost a little bit more, but I felt that I could rest a little bit easier at night. So. And so then marketing was, I'm just sort of in that turmoil at the moment of getting the message out about these stories in St Kilda. And I was very excited to launch the book down at Readings. I love this. This is going to be my favourite page of anything. This was the What's On at Readings in November 2015. And with all these famous people all around me, we've got the Whiteleys, we've got the goodness knows what, there's David Willis in the centre launching the Majestic. So that was, I thought, yay, here we go. So that's a terrific one that I enjoyed. See there that we've got the St Kilda Press and just a couple of things, including the book launch. So where we're at the moment, just a couple more of my media things. Our sales are steady and regular, and 11 months on, I'm averaging about two books a week across all of my outlets. I've got Readings, both in St Kilda and the State Library, stocking the book. The National Trust, here at the Royal, of course, we've got copies downstairs, and a couple of homeware shops also stock me. So across all of those, I'm managing to sell about two a week, which I think is okay. And I'm yet to recover, and I probably never will, the outlay of the book itself. But I didn't do it for the money. I did it for the stories. And so just to end, I'm excited on that note to be able to contribute to the work of all types of historians, the local, the academic, the professional, and the family. And we all have a part in that recording. Thank you, everyone.